previously.
So Michelle is here to share her story, but I think that what you have to say is going to be really, really important to our listeners.
Finally, I worked up the nerve and told him that I couldn't have children, and if he wanted children, I understood if he didn't want to be with me anymore. And he said he loved me.
Because people were sensitive, I guess, to yes. how difficult that might be for you to be in that situation.
Yeah.
This is Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Hi, this is Dr. Natalie Berger. I'm here with Dr. Thomas Vaughn, and we are bringing you another edition of The Birds and Bees, or Beyond the Birds and Bees. So, you know, bringing you the show today on a beautiful Saturday afternoon. I feel like we really have deserved this after all the really hot weather we've had recently.
It was so nice for it to be cool this morning. Oh, my gosh, and I can't believe other people in the country will think 72 in the morning's cool, but
yeah.
It felt
oh, my
right.
gosh, it was beautiful. And you know, such a beautiful thing to happen on a three-day weekend. And I realize a lot of you guys are probably in the car or traveling or on the road getting to your vacation destination. But it certainly is a beautiful Saturday afternoon.
And thank goodness for the rain yesterday.
Yes.
That's very nice, too.
We are loving it. So yes. So basically, last week we were talking some about weight and infertility. As well as discussing sort of some of the personal aspects of fertility treatment. And what we wanted to do today was get into a little bit more one particular thing that can cause fertility problems. And this thing that I'm referring to would be fibroids or fibroid tumors, which you may have heard about before. And these are actually things that can cause problems with fertility as well as other kinds of symptoms as well, too.
They're exceptionally common.
Yeah,
I mean, so common that this discussion will transcend fertility and just general gynecology and health and with any woman.
Right. And so for those of you who are listening and not necessarily thinking about fertility or have already, you know, completed your childbearing, or you're not quite at the point of wanting to consider having a family yet, this is still possibly applicable to you as well, too. And we first want to discuss, you know, what really are fibroids?
Yeah, that's really a good question. I think to start out with, the first thing I'll tell a patient is that the chance of it being malignant, cancer, mm-hmm. is less than 1/3 of 1%. Just to put everyone at ease, because when you're told by someone you have a tumor, and fibroids right. generally are considered tumors, benign tumors, everyone starts thinking the worst.
Correct.
Oh my God, what if it's cancer? What's going to happen now?
Right. Right. So it's very common for us to call them fibroids or fibroid tumors. And in our world and medicine world, to us, tumor does not necessarily mean bad. In fact, there are many benign things that can be just abnormally grown, but are not true cancer. But
yeah, it's just a growth. It's really true. It's a growth. There's many growths that are benign. And then unfortunately, there's some that aren't. But
right.
it is a growth.
Right. And it's a particular kind of growth that occurs within the uterus, and it appears to be the overgrowth of a certain kind of muscle cell. So unlike some other growths in the uterus that are soft and fleshy, and what I'm really referring to are polyps, which are another common kind of finding in the uterus, these fibroids are pesky because they are much tougher, and they grow more into the tissue of the uterus. And they can be more challenging to remove depending upon their location.
Yes, the uterus, as probably everyone knows, is a big muscle. And in fact, that's important because as it expands with a baby, at some point the body wants to expel the baby, so to speak, or push the baby through the vaginal canal to deliver the baby. So it is a muscle. And so this tumor can arise from within the muscle. And think of fibroid, think of fibrous, think of firm. It's a firm, benign growth in the wall of the uterus that will occur in at least 25% of women in reproductive age if they haven't had a hysterectomy. So it's exceptionally common, mm-hmm. but they're not always tumors that require treatment.
Right.
And also, you know, the other thing, too, is that when women are individuals read about this on the internet, everybody Googles everything, the medical term is leiomyoma. Mm-hmm. So just realize that that's what it is called among physicians, but fibroids is the most common term used.
And actually, you know, where I was when I was training in Georgia, which is where I'm from, there was another more common term for it from the patients. They call them fireballs.
Yeah. So, that was true in East Texas, too.
So, yeah. Fireballs in the Eucharist, I think. Yeah. So, yes, you may hear some different terms for these fibroid growths. And, you know, what's really interesting about them is it's not necessarily the size of the fibroid that can be the issue. It really, like real estate, can really be dependent upon location, location, location.
Absolutely. You know, and think about this. One thing I will tell patients is that it's like if you have a little piece of sand and you have it in your hand, it's not a problem. But if you get it in the eye or get it in your shoe, this little bitty thing can cause a lot of problems. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you can have a rock in your pocket and it doesn't bother you at all. So it really is location. Location is so important.
Mm-hmm. And we know that technically fibroids, there are sort of three general areas where they can grow. Some fibroids grow within the cavity of the uterus or the space where a pregnancy would grow. We know that other fibroids start off more from the middle of the muscle wall of the uterus, and still other fibroids grow more on the outside of the uterus. And especially these last ones that grow on the outside of the uterus, they can be quite large but cause relatively little in terms of symptoms until they get really big.
And you know what? The ones on the inside of the uterus can get large also. However, they cause problems so early that the patient will present herself to her physician before they are really, really big, because they cause so much a problem with bleeding, even leading to anemia, even where you think the bleeding may never stop.
Mm-hmm. So even relatively small fibroids, and you know, even ones that are what we think are relatively small, which are 2-3 centimeters, those can cause big problems if they're inside the uterus. The ones that are in the more of the wall of the uterus, people can still have problems with painful, heavy, crampy periods, but they can grow to a larger size before people might seek treatment because they may not be as bothered by them.
Absolutely, and if you, some people are not familiar with using the word centimeter and using more inches, but 2-3 centimeters is about 1 inch. So if you can just visualize that in regard to the size, but something that seems that small can really cause some problems if it's in the wrong place.
And, you know, talking especially about the people who are most at risk for having fibroids, there are certainly certain populations that have a higher chance of developing them.
It seems most common in the black population. Mm-hmm. But let me tell you, even in the populations where it's not as common, it's still common.
Right. And certainly if you have a mother or a sisters or a grandmothers with history of fibroids, then you also do have a higher chance of having them as well, too.
Absolutely. In fact, if you read about them, you will see that most of the things that are on the internet will say the cause is unknown. But probably the cause is a genetic cause. And therefore, just as you said, that if there are a lot of fibroids in the family, then the individual's more likely to develop them at some time in their life.
Right. And so as we had talked about earlier, just because you have a fibroid or some fibroids, you don't necessarily need to address them. You don't need to necessarily treat them either medically or surgically. And, you know, there are certain populations of people, though, who would benefit potentially from doing some further intervention. And these people are typically people with heavy, painful periods, or if they have fibroids that have grown on the outside of the uterus, they're having a lot of problems with constipation or feeling like they have to go to the bathroom a lot, or people with infertility problems.
You know, Natalie, I will tell my patients that it's very common to have these. And that just because they're there, just as you said, they don't need to be treated surgically or medically. And to think of it like a mole on your skin. If you have a mole on your skin or moles on your skin, you don't just remove all of them. Mm-hmm. But if it acts up, you remove it, right?
Right.
Well, I think that's the best way to think of a fibroid. Just because it's there and it's not acting up, not causing any problems, doesn't mean that it has to be removed. Then the symptoms that you talked about, where it is starting to cause problems with bleeding, maybe fertility, heaviness in the pelvis, those sorts of things, now all of a sudden, or not all of a sudden, but gradually even, it's causing a problem. So now it's time to address it.
Mm-hmm. And there are different kinds of ways to address fibroids medically or surgically, though it's true that if you are dealing with fibroids and they are impacting your fertility, then technically the surgical approaches are going to be the most recommended or beneficial.
Yeah, I think in general, it's important to realize that it really is not a medical disease. It's more of a surgical disease. Mm-hmm. That even if you give medications that may shrink the fibroid, what you're dealing with now is that because you can't be on that medication for a long time, when you stop it, the fibroid almost blossoms back to its same size. Now, you can use medication to kind of control some of the bleeding caused by the fibroids, but if you really have to deal with the fibroid, it's a surgical disease.
Mm-hmm. And it's true for fertility patients. There is one, you know, typical type of fertility or surgical approach that would be recommended, and that would be removing the fibroid itself. There are some other surgical and sort of semi-surgical techniques that can be done in terms of, certainly if you are done with childbearing, removing the uterus, or there are other procedures called uterine artery embolization, as well as there's this MRI guide.
Yeah, and you know, I just want to make a comment on what you just said, too. The definitive treatment for fibroids so that they don't return is hysterectomy. You're right. Mm-hmm. Now, for us, usually women who present to us with fibroids are there because they don't want to remove their uterus. So we're focused more on reconstructive surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an important concept. And we'll see patients who are not really trying to get pregnant, or they're not having fertility issues, but they just don't want to lose the uterus.
Mm-hmm.
And even if they've completed childbearing, they still say, I just don't want to lose my parts.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it's our job then to save the uterus, so to speak. So for us, we're kind of taking it off the table, hysterectomy. And in fact, if that's what the patient wanted, I suspect they would never be in our office.
Probably not. Yeah.
Yeah. So then we have to decide what the best treatment for the best surgical treatment is. And again, we come back to location.
Right.
Right.
Right. And it's true that depending upon the fibroids, sometimes we'll recommend an approach from going from the outside of the uterus. And a lot of times we're able to accomplish this by doing minimally invasive surgery with very small incisions in the abdomen. Sometimes for larger or many more fibroids, we might have to make a little bit larger of an incision in the area of a C-section incision. But it's true that if the fibroid is within the space that a pregnancy would grow within the uterus, we're actually able to remove the fibroid without making any incision, basically going with a skinny camera inside the uterus and shaving off the fibroid.
Yes, and of course that is with an anesthetic.
Oh, yes.
Yes, it is with an anesthetic, because opening the cervix would be uncomfortable. And that is really one of the more satisfying procedures, because you can take a patient really struggling with bleeding and all sorts of problems, and with this outpatient procedure, just wake up and it's like gone.
Right.
And you still have the
outpatient
uterus.
Yeah. And yeah, even, you know, if we're having to deal with things abdominally, if we're able to use that procedure called laparoscopy, where you make a few small incisions in the belly and are able to take the fibroids out that way from the outside of the uterus, that also is an outpatient procedure. And it's considered minimally invasive. And the return to work and other activity is much faster than a traditional incision.
Yes, with laparoscopy, usually women are at the surgical facility maybe a half a day at most, and then they're off work, of course, that day, and I usually recommend they take the following day off, so they really are only missing 2 days of work. And, of course, if they're having it done on a Friday, then they've only missed 1 day at work, and they're back at work on Monday. And that's pretty much the laparoscopic procedure, and even if you're treating endometriosis or other things, but if you're doing a laparoscopic myomectomy. That means, of course, removing the fibroid through the laparoscope. So this is really what we prefer. It's nice if you can do it through the cervix, through the vagina, through the cervix, called a hysteroscope. Hystero means uterus. Scope means to look with the scope. And the other is laparoscope through the an incision just below the umbilicus, which is lapro, stands for abdomen, and scope means to look that way. So if we can treat these fibroids with either of these two procedures, it is really back to work and back to normal activities really quickly.
Yeah, it's a huge thing. We are getting, you know, more and more sophisticated with the surgical instruments and stuff, so it's giving us a lot more options than we had even 10, 20 years ago. But what we're going to do is wrap up this segment for in just a moment, and we will begin talking a little bit more in the next segment not only finishing up fibroids, but also talking a little bit more about for those folks who are friends or relatives of folks struggling with infertility, some of the things you may not want to say to them. We're on Talk Radio 1370. Feel free to give us a call at 390-1370.
We'll be back.
Welcome back to Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Hey, this is Natalie Berger again. I'm here with Thomas Vaughn, and we are again bringing you Beyond the Birds and Bees. And we were talking in the last segment about fibroids, which are very common muscle growths or tumors of the uterus that can affect people with and without infertility.
And we talked about surgical treatments, doing a hysteroscopy through the vagina, through the cervix, for those inside the cavity, and laparoscopy for those outside the outside wall of the uterus or in the wall. And one of the things that's important for women to remember is that if these fibroids that are removed are deep in the wall, then they may need to have a cesarean section whenever they have a baby.
Mm-hmm. And that's to protect them, because we know that the most stress that the uterus can be is when it is greatly enlarged, as it would be during a full-term pregnancy. And when it's contracting, which is basically squeezing and relaxing, and this is the process it undergoes during labor. And because there is possibly, after that kind of a procedure where the fibroid is removed from deeper within the muscle of the uterus, there may be some weakness in that area. And there is a very low chance, though possible chance, of the weakness
separating. Yeah. You know, and part of that, too, is because this is a muscle. And when you cut the muscle and you sew it back together and it heals, it doesn't really heal with muscle fibers, but just a scar. So that particular part cannot contract. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it can kind of bulge. And that becomes a risk. Now, the uterus is almost always strong enough to carry a baby, even if it's not really strong enough to labor a baby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing how resilient the uterus is. And we think about how small it is, you know, and during the non-pregnant times, and it's like, what, roughly?
2 to 3 inches, like 7 centimeters tall.
And then
maybe 2 to 3 centimeters wide, which is like only an inch, inch and a half wide.
And then at full term, this uterus, this very same uterus, can be...
Well, it's going to be all the way up to your ribs, right? And it's going to be at least 10 to 12 inches, 40 centimeters.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is amazing what the uterus can do. And it probably gets no respect, right?
Well,
Rodney Dangerfield.
You know, the crazy thing is it can enlarge so much and then it can shrink down again.
Oh, it's pretty amazing. And thank goodness it shrinks down, because that keeps a woman from bleeding too much after she delivers her baby. It kind of squeezes the vessels that come through the uterine wall.
Mm-hmm.
So it's real, real important. And, you know, interestingly, I know this is off the subject a little bit, but women who breastfeed, that will cause the uterus to cramp a little bit. And any woman who's had a baby would remember that. But that also helps with preventing bleeding after having a baby.
Mm-hmm. The uterus really is an amazing organ.
And what we do, though, is back to fibroids, of course, is that we're cutting into the wall to remove the fibroid and then repairing the wall. And usually we repair it like in several layers so it'll be strong enough to carry a baby. In the old days, I said, if you didn't go all the way into the cavity, you didn't need to do a C-section. But the truth is that if you really go deep toward the cavity, a C-section is probably the safest thing to do anyway.
Mm-hmm. And it's true. With people with fertility problems who have fibroids that warrant treatment, sometimes we will use a medicine before surgical treatment to help us out. Though we don't depend upon, or we don't use medical treatment as in and of itself as a treatment if we are dealing with fibroids and infertility issues.
Now, this medication that is very helpful is called Lupron. And what it does is it turns off the part of the pituitary gland that stimulates the ovary. So therefore, the ovary's not making hormones. And the fibroids depend a little bit on the ovarian hormones to grow and expand, and particularly estrogen. So if we turn that off, then maybe that fibroid will commonly shrink. And the time that it's really helpful to use this is whenever you're having too much bleeding, so you're trying to get the woman to not have periods so she can build her blood count up, and the other when you're trying to shrink the size so maybe you make it more easily removed without a bigger incision.
Yeah, and this medication, you know, can cause some of those menopausal symptoms like hot flashes and dryness and mood changes and such. But it's a temporary medication, and it really can be very beneficial in cases where the fibroid is so large that trying to deal with it surgically, it may be a lot safer to have it shrunken before you address it. And we know that actually also women who end up having fibroids and then going through menopause, their fibroids tend to shrink as well too, though they don't go away.
Correct. And that's the same concept that when a woman goes through menopause, she's gone through menopause because the ovary's not making estrogen to stimulate the uterine lining to bleed. Therefore, there's very little estrogen. Therefore, the fibroid has lost some of its nourishment and shrinks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so these fibroids, you know, can be pesky, but certainly they are not, they're very common and not always need to be addressed. A lot of times, like if you've been diagnosed with them by your OBGYN or the provider, they will monitor you with ultrasounds, which are typically the kinds of ways that we look at the fibroids. Though you can, for big fibroids, get a sense of them doing a physical examination, an ultrasound is a quick and relatively inexpensive way to measure and monitor fibroids.
Correct. Yeah, because we actually expect fibroids to grow, and generally they grow slowly. Mm-hmm. If they were to grow rapidly, then that would be a fibroid acting up again, which would then kind of beg the question, should it be removed? So that's one of the other things that we think about when we're trying to make a decision as to whether we recommend removing the fibroid or not. One is that rapid growth, in addition to what you said about bleeding and discomfort and pressure and everything.
Gotcha. So basically, that's our story about fibroids. Again, you know, can be...
Even though we've talked about what we're doing for reconstructive surgery, there you will read about other treatments that are available, but generally these are reserved for women who are for sure, at least in their own mind, that they're not wanting to have another baby. And that would be what you mentioned earlier about embolization. That's where a little bead or something is put into the artery that feeds the fibroid. It cuts off the blood supply and the fibroid dies.
Mm-hmm. And there is also this newer treatment, Exablate, which is the...
Exablate is another treatment, you're right, where by using an MRI to focus particular sound waves, that you can destroy the fibroid without destroying other organs there, which is like the bowel and the bladder. But not everyone's a candidate for it. For instance, if the fibroid's right up against the rectum or the colon, then they might be at a little risk for injury of that organ, so therefore they may not be a candidate for that. So, but those are the things that you think about. And there was one that was popular about maybe 15 or 20 years ago, 10 or 15 years ago, called cryoablation, where you actually froze the fibroid. And problem with it is it was very slow. It caused a lot of discomfort and could cause adhesions as well. Mm-hmm. So it kind of fell out of favor.
Mm-hmm.
But if a woman is through having children and she wants to avoid a hysterectomy or a big incision for myomectomy, some of these techniques are beneficial and are available to patients.
Which is great, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's true, yeah. For fertility patients, we have a more focused approach to fibroids, but for folks who are not interested in future fertility, there may be more options for treatment for them.
And the concept for us is to try to just remove the tumor and save the uterus, where these other things like the embolization may take care of the blood supply to the fibroid, but also may interfere with the blood supply to other parts of the uterus, and therefore it not be as good a baby carriage as it would have been before. And I think when women think through that, the common sense will help them understand why it's better just to remove the tumor and not injure or affect the rest of the uterus at that time.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So basically, we wanted to also start talking about some other, you know, things as well, too. And one thing among them is talking to folks that you know who have issues with infertility and some of the things that you would not want to say. We've addressed this in shows past, you know, some of those comments that you feel you're trying to be helpful and informative and supportive. But when they are heard by the other side, i.e. the people who are undergoing fertility issues, they can definitely come across a little harshly.
You know, I think everyone's friend who wants to say something to their friend who's having trouble conceiving would like to say the right thing and invariably say the wrong thing. And I can't tell you how many times our patients have said, my best friend says, all my husband does is he looks at me and I'm pregnant. Well, he probably does something else. We don't want to talk about it, but he probably does something else. But it's just that kind of comment that is even more hurtful, not maliciously, though.
Right.
People feel that they have to say something and don't know what to say and then say the wrong thing. And the best advice is just be a listener.
Right. Say, I'm sorry. And even if you feel comfortable saying, I'm not sure what exactly I should say, but I want to support you and I want you to know that I'm here for you. Even though it may not sound as satisfying as some of the other thoughts that you may have, that may be what they need to know or maybe need to hear. And it's true that even though you may not know it because people are so private about infertility, you are probably interacting with people on a day-to-day basis who are dealing with infertility problems. So even though you're not obviously aware all the time, just to be sensitive to this, because we know that there are about 7-8 million people in the United States who are dealing with infertility problems, and it is a very difficult thing to undergo. And some people have even likened it to, the fact that when you have other kinds of grief, such as somebody passing away in the family or so, you have this sort of one event where you have a painful grieving process and you're able to cope with it and then move on, versus this recurring grief that occurs with infertility and even, failure with fertility treatment. It is a constant reminder every single month when a woman gets her period that she's not pregnant. And so it's a very difficult thing to deal with on an ongoing basis, whereas sometimes it'd be easier just to deal with one factor in time and then to be able to deal with it conclusively afterward. It can be hard to deal with this repetitively recurring issue.
You know, it is so true, and it's so hard to deal with that I've had a few patients who actually were timing intercourse to not get pregnant, because then they didn't feel like they were a failure when they didn't get pregnant. Mm-hmm. They almost subconsciously avoided being sexually active around the ovulation time. They were almost backwards in their thought process, because you're just reminded every month that it didn't work, and women will take it on like they're being a failure with this. So it is a very difficult area. And I think also it's human nature to want to give advice, and invariably the advice is something that people don't need to hear, and it's not really appropriate. Like, you need to go home and relax. Don't think about it. Mm-hmm. Right. Don't think. It's like a bladder infection. You have to think about it. You can't not think about it, right? And right. So it's really all of those sorts of things are just kind of like a lack of insight.
Mm-hmm. It's true that, typically for couples or folks who are going through infertility, there tend to be three different kinds of resolutions. A, they end up either on their own or undergoing fertility treatment and conceiving the child or family that they had envisioned. B, they decide depending upon whether fertility treatment is successful or not, or if they decide treatment is not something to consider, to move forward with a childless life. Or C, they have a family in a way they didn't envision or imagine initially, such as by adopting or using donor egg IVF. But these are different possibilities for people who are undergoing fertility problems. And it's a very personal decision as to how long they continue with certain kinds of treatments, or if they decide that for them really the best thing is to consider adoption or a childless life or donor egg. And it is very important to make sure you are sensitive to people's needs, that one size does not fit all. Different folks are going to feel differently and have different perspectives about fertility treatments or adoption or such, and to be supportive no matter what they choose, even though if you felt you were going through something like this, it wouldn't be what you would do.
I think it's so true, and it's just at the key to this is resolution. Whatever that resolution is, again, adoption, you do become pregnant, or you decide that you're going to move on, and there is something to be said for that. And, you know, it's up to physicians sometimes to say you need to quit doing the procedures you're doing. Like, mm-hmm. It's not going to work, or at least it's so unlikely to work, you need to move on to something else. And I admit that it is difficult to say that, because it's kind of like they want hope, mm-hmm. but we have an obligation to be sure that they have the data.
Right. It is one of the most difficult conversations that we have, especially when we've been undergoing fertility treatments with patients, and there's been the hope every time that treatment has started, even though we didn't have success with it, that every time there's a new hope of success. And there does come a point with fertility treatments and certain amounts of information that we would say continuing something like this is not going to be in your best interest in terms of your psychological, your personal, emotional well-being, that putting you through this recurrent treatment that is not likely to be effective is not fair to you or your family. So those are very difficult, you know, conversations to have. And certainly we try to give people as many options, even if what they are thinking about, you know, may not be the ultimate way they end up pursuing things. But we will certainly talk a little bit more in the next segment about, again, things not to say to folks who are dealing with infertility. And we are on Talk Radio 1370 AM.
Don't hesitate to join us, 390-1370.
Welcome back to Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Hi, this is Natalie Berger again with Thomas Vaughn, and we are Beyond the Birds and Bees. And we're again talking a little bit more about infertility etiquette, and basically what not to say to folks who are having issues with fertility. Just as a reminder, we are at 390-1370 for any folks who have any questions or so. But again, you know, things not to mention. And as you said, Thomas, earlier, saying things like relaxing and it will happen is like one of the worst things, because people, I think, hear it so often.
Yeah, I mean, go home and relax. I mean, how can you make a couple more tense? Oh my God, than to say go home and relax. You know, the best way to get them to relax is to say, here's the plan. Here's how we're going to work through it as a physician. Mm-hmm. We're kind of talking about what friends can say, but as a physician, this is a plan. This is what we're going to do. And actually, you really, this is kind of out of your control, or you wouldn't be in our office, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, kind of like sex isn't working. And so this is what we're going to work through. And hopefully with that, that's going to help them realize that they have a goal and there's some hope with that. Mm-hmm. And of course, in all the things that we talked about in earlier shows about eating right, exercising, and all those other things.
Mm-hmm. And another thing, you know, to not say would be trying to say, well, gosh, this is not the worst thing that could happen. There could be like even worse catastrophes in your life, and this is not that bad. And people,
well, that's for sure. Oh my gosh. But you know, everybody says that.
Right.
And it just doesn't make the couple feel better, because what they're struggling with is a huge deal to them. And you know, they feel, and I think they're right, that no one really knows what it's like unless you've walked in their shoes.
Right. And who would be the authority in terms of saying this isn't the worst thing that could happen? Because depending upon your feelings about having a family and your strength of conviction and emotion, I mean, that could be the worst thing. And so even though it's meant to be helpful to try to gain perspective, in this scenario, it really can come across very harshly.
You're exactly right. And really, we just don't know those things. So it's best to avoid that. And if anyone's listening who has a friend or a couple that's struggling with this, remember, sometimes the best thing to say is nothing. You know, if the mm-hmm. topic comes up, to just be a good listener, because advice is probably not going to be very helpful at all.
And, you know, something that comes up sometimes, I don't hear it quite as often as a complaint from patients, but folks who say things like, well, it just wasn't meant to be, or God just didn't intend for you to be parents, and it's like, gee, that's a
yeah, that's really tough. I mean, oh my gosh, is that really hard on a couple? And then I think when you have a friend who is struggling with getting pregnant, and then you become pregnant, then you really don't know what to say, and almost you're embarrassed to be around them, and it's really hard for them to share in the happiness of you being pregnant. But you know, the best thing to be is just a friend. Even if you're even as a couple, you're pregnant, still be a friend. And for God's sake, don't complain about your feet swelling.
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean?
Yeah, it's true. You have to be careful about that, about complaining about things in pregnancy to folks who would cut off their arm to be in the same position that you're
the
in.
The woman's going, I would love for my feet to be swollen, excuse me.
Right.
And that's actually one of the problems sometimes, even in physicians' offices, if there's a lot of pregnant people and then they're seeing their physician for infertility and all they hear is the complaints. And it's, I'm not trying to minimize that it is uncomfortable to be pregnant and all of those sorts of things. It's just that of all things to say around someone who would love to be pregnant.
Right. It's a delicate position to be pregnant around folks who are having fertility issues. But again, to be supportive and to say, I'm there for you. Please tell me what I can do for you so that I can, you know, make this better and help you. And not focusing on your own pregnancy would be certainly recommended issues or things. And, you know, you also want to be careful about being jokey-jokey because sometimes people who get uncomfortable in a scenario will start using humor to diffuse the discomfort. And even, you know, people who have great sense of humor may not find this particular topic so funny. So you really want to be careful about trying to minimize the problem or trying to put a humorous spin on it.
I would consider that high risk.
Right. High risk for not being a friend anymore.
Certainly high risk for saying the right thing, for it being received the right way, and that you're more likely than not to have not said the right thing.
Right.
At least from the perspective, the couple's perspective. And so, you know, and also couples that are struggling with this also struggle with their parents and in-laws. They always want to give advice. I mean, my goodness, that's what parents are for, right? That doesn't work either.
Yeah, what I heard recently is apparently somebody's parent was saying, gosh, yeah, I know this whole infertility thing is a real problem. I'm constantly being asked by my friends when my grandchildren are going to start appearing. And so that can be a tough thing to hear. So, yes, I mean, certainly there are a number of comments, though well-meaning, do not translate well when they are actually heard by folks who are dealing with fertility issues. And, you know, it is important to show them that you care. And you know, different holidays can be difficult for people who are trying to become parents and who have not yet succeeded. And especially Mother's Day and Father's Day can be challenging days because it is yet another reminder, in addition to the baby showers they've been invited to or to the pregnant people they may encounter during day-to-day life, that, you know, yet another reminder that this is what we want, but we're not there yet.
Well, how about Christmas? Oh, my gosh.
Not too,
because
yeah.
Christmas, supposedly about religion, a mm-hmm. Christian holiday, turns out to be also a time that is celebrated and for many weeks and months in advance. And what it really comes down to is not only the religious holiday, but families coming together. So it can be a really hard time for people also from the standpoint of having lost a mother or father or grandparent or something like that. And then for the couple that would love to have a child that's underneath the tree opening presents, it's a really tough time.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes Mother's Day and Father's Day can kind of slip away a little bit because it just doesn't get as much fanfare. But boy, Christmas is a tough time for patients.
Right. And, you know, to also spin it to say, okay, what are some things that you should say to folks with infertility? Well, I think that, you know, again, the support issue and saying, I'm here for you. I'm ready to do what you need me to do, even if I don't know what exactly you need, but please let me know. And, you know, just being a friend in that scenario can be so helpful. And if they have not explored options of seeking help from their OBGYN or from a fertility specialist, if, you know, that is something that some folks, if you feel comfortable bringing up, though it is a personal decision, and not everybody is going to be receptive to that.
Yes, for sure. And as a physician, we also have counselors that are very good at visiting with couples if they feel like that would be helpful. I have to bring up something that I talked about on the show maybe back in June, and that is the difficulty with also the couple, the mm-hmm. man and the woman, and how they deal with the problem a little differently, and almost it can drive a wedge where you don't understand what it's like to be a woman who can't get pregnant, or the guy saying, feeling like, I can't even get my wife pregnant. What kind of guy am I? Mm-hmm. I mean, so there can be a lot of stress there. And we talked about this earlier, and that is that women process by talking and men don't want to talk because they can't fix it. And so if you can't fix it, then I'd rather not talk about it. And when the women are talking about it, the guys are assuming that they need to give an answer on how to fix it. So it just becomes a real difficult situation. But I try to tell the guys, the women are not asking for a solution. They're asking you to listen. Mm-hmm. Goes back to the same thing we've been talking about with friends. Just being a listener if you want to talk about it.
Yeah, and I know this is certainly a recurrent thing that we talk about at almost every show, but, you know, especially for couples where the woman needs to talk and the man is not comfortable with discussing things in those ways and finding a different way to cope with his feelings about infertility, support groups can be huge, or even connecting with people who've been in your position. And that can become easier than you think in scenarios where, you know, if you talk to folks even a little bit about your fertility issues, your desires for pregnancy, people tend to start coming out of the woodwork in terms of their own personal struggles. And so I think for women, a lot of times, finding that emotional support, whether it be through a more traditional support group, or sometimes if it's a more private thing that they want to keep, talking to a counselor, or even finding friends or relatives that may have gone through similar scenarios, all those things can be so helpful for women to deal with their emotions as they're going through this process.
You know, the other thing, too, is that a lot of couples, and I think more so women than men, may feel guilty about something in the past. Maybe they had a termination and they feel like that may have caused injury to the uterus or something like that. Or someone will say, maybe I'm being punished by God because I terminated a pregnancy and now I can't get pregnant. So we have to be sensitive to those things also, in addition to they smoked a lot and they did hurt ovarian function, and all of these things can come out. There's so much there that is very important to recognize.
Right.
And I think that this is an ongoing problem in our practice with not only trying to get rid of fibroids, as we talked about, but to be sure that they have the emotional needs. And I think education is the best thing. The more the woman, the more the couple knows, the better it is for them to deal with it. Data is really helpful.
Right. And having sort of understanding of the plan and how we're going to approach things for a lot of folks can take away this sort of nebulousness of what's going to happen next and make it a little bit more focused. Like, this is what we're going to try. And if this doesn't work, then we have this as an option next, or this is an option. So having some sort of a plan can help a lot of folks as well, too.
I think so, too. And also, back to the fix-it thing, it's not like something's broken and when your car's broken, you take it in, you drive it out, and it's fixed. This is something where sometimes you don't know exactly why it's not working, but you do have treatments that you can tell couples that will significantly increase the chance of conceiving, even if you don't know exactly why they can't get pregnant. And that's what it's all about, really, is if you do choose this treatment, this is a chance of success and taking them down that path and resolution, as we said earlier.
Right. Well, we've enjoyed talking to you and with you on Beyond the Birds and Bees. This has been Natalie Berger and Thomas Vaughn. We're physicians at Texas Fertility Center. Feel free to look at our website, which is www.txfertility.com.
Remember, we were talking so much about how important education is. The website is great.
Yes. And we look forward to talking again next week.